From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and today Chris and I have two very special guests for you. The first is Terry Messier. Now, Messier is a hummingbird rehabilitator, author, and star of the 2024 Sundance film, Every Little Thing, which was an audience favorite, and it actually screened this past weekend at the Jim Sandy Auditorium with Park City Film. We'll talk about her work and how it reverberates positively into the world. And then award-winning author Stephanie Anderson comes on to talk with us about her brand new book, From the Ground Up, The Women Revolutionizing Regenerative Agriculture. Anderson will share stories from the female farmers she's visited and how they are transforming our thoughts about the food chain. All that is coming up right here, right now on This Green Earth. So stick with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And now we're very pleased to introduce you to Terry Messier. Terry is a hummingbird rehabilitator, author, and is featured in the acclaimed Sundance 2024 film, Every Little Thing. With 20 years in rescue work, she highlights a hummingbird's ecological importance and how they inspire conservation. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me, Claire. It's my pleasure.
Well, you just released this film, as we saw, 2024 is when it was screened at Sundance here in Park City, and it's based on your writings in 2015. You wrote a book called Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds at Hollywood. So I'd like to get your origin story and how you got started on this path of hummingbird rehabilitation and why you wanted to share that story.
Right. In the book, it's detailed how it happened. But long story short, one of my cats that was an indoor cat escaped from the house during a Santa Ana windstorm, similar to the ones that LA just had during, you know, that started the fires. And he always went crazy with the wind, and he escaped. He wasn't supposed to be out. And he brought an unfeathered nestling back to the house that had blown out of its nest. He didn't hurt it. He just rescued it. And so I had never seen a baby hummingbird. I had no clue what it was. And I had to kind of look it up. And then I finally figured out that this is a hummingbird. So this was back kind of when internet was extremely primitive. Most people can't even imagine, but the internet was, this is like 2000, right? Early 2000. There were just like, the internet was just like an ad, like you could find somebody to hire someone, right? It's all static. There weren't videos. And so I just called around, and I finally found a veterinarian that referred me to a woman who finally became my mentor down in Torrance, and dropped the bird off with her after a couple days of looking. And then I thought I was done. And then a year later, we had the biggest rains we've ever had in LA. They were just tsunami rains. And I had been watching a nest outside of my house because I was so excited because I'd done a hummingbird rescue, right? Sure enough, the nest washed out in the rainstorm, and I had to rescue a baby that day on my way to work. So I knew where to take it, but before I could get out of the house, Jean, my mentor, said, "Hey, would you like to help since you've been here a couple times?" And in my naivete, I said, "Sure, why not?" And within a year, it had consumed my life.
And you talk about that life consumption. You have now been looked to as an expert in the field of hummingbird rehabilitation. You have done your due diligence to understand these species and what makes them unique. So let's get into some of those things that makes these birds so unique and why we as humans are so drawn to them.
So they are remarkable in so many ways. You know, that's an hour discussion, but essentially their flight skills are just unsurpassed in the bird world. And their niche in nature is unique. They're the only birds that can hover. They make 7,000-mile migratory journeys, some species from Mexico to Alaska, and they stop at the same feeders year after year on the same dates, banding studies have shown. They can also, because they can see in the ultraviolet range, they can see flowers from a mile away when they're flying over a canyon. It's not like where we see kind of, oh, there's a red flower in the distance. They see it like a neon sign that's glowing when they see red. And that's why red is such a powerful color for them. And so they are remarkably adept at moving and adjusting to changes in the environment, unlike a lot of creatures that can't move that much. Hummingbirds can move very quickly and very far. They are only indigenous to the Americas. So they range from Alaska down to South America. And there are different species in many different ecosystems along the way. But LA has more hummingbirds than any city in the world.
Oh, wow.
Why is that?
You know, I think it's just a combination of perfect environment where they can stay year round. And the fact that Angelenos have planted so much introduced vegetation that gives them flowers and a lot of food to eat. Because prior to LA being settled, I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of Los Angeles before the 1930s, but it's just fields. It's just grassland. Beverly Hills is just it's just prairie. You know, it's just open space with some scrub brush. There weren't that many hummingbirds around back then because there wasn't that. The food sources were not so rich, but with human arrival and human plantings, they have thrived in LA. And I think as rehabbers, we have added to the population because we release about 2,000 rehabbed birds a year. And over 20 years, you can do the math. So they multiply quickly. So
2,000 a year, you know, that's roughly 5-6 a day. How many are you taking in every day?
Well, Chris, I'm doing the telephones right now from Portland. I'm not in LA right now. I was there during the film, but I'm currently just manning the phones because it's a full-time job. I've gotten 20 calls today already. Most of the calls I can resolve over the phone because there are birds people misunderstand the nesting habits of the mothers, or it's a baby down that we need to re-nest, or it's a bird that's injured. And so I can do most of it over the phone. If I can't, I send them to 3 or 4 of the rehabbers that are in Southern California. But 5 a day is a low estimate. In June, we get 40 a day because that's a peak nesting season. And then, you know, a lot of them don't make it, but I would say I've been involved in the rescue rehab of 20,000 hummingbirds over the last 20 years, easily.
That's incredible. And what would you say is the most common or their biggest adversaries? What are the reasons for them needing rehabilitation?
That's a really good question. I would say one of the top problems is tree trimmers, unfortunately, and it's so depressing because that's something that we can correct. But everybody trims their trees in the spring and summer, which is when all birds nest, not just hummingbirds. So they cut thousands of nests out of the trees. And, you know, we're at a constant war with the city and with weekend gardeners trying to get people to educate people to stop trimming. It's much better for the trees to trim during the winter anyway, according to arborists. So that's the main one. And then, you know, because they live close to us, they hit windows, they hit cars. The mothers move off the nest at a certain point and it throws human observers into a panic. And then babies end up on the ground a lot, because it's natural for the young birds to end up in the ground. People don't realize that, but they can end up on the ground for a day or two before they take flight. So I re-nest those. I do about 500 shoebox re-nests every year. I did 5 yesterday. So, and then the mother can keep feeding the baby and they don't have to go to rehab. But we get a lot of birds in rehab, probably, I don't know, 1,000 a year.
Wow. Is it primarily broken bones or other injuries like that, like you mentioned, from collisions or falls or so?
Yeah, head injuries are common because hummingbirds, because they fly horizontally and they fly fast. So when they hit something, they hit head first. And they often hit cars when they're trying to learn how to fly. They'll hit a car on the road, or they hit people's windows a lot. And they fight a lot.
Right.
The males are extremely aggressive. Because hummingbirds don't pair bond like most birds. Most birds pair bond so they have a mate for the season or a mate for life. In the hummingbird world, the male has no role in nesting and raising the young. His sole objective is to reproduce. And so they're extremely territorial. They're little dinosaurs that just combat is their way of life. So we get a lot of those injured males. And unfortunately, that's part of nature. But because people have so many feeders around, it does tend to happen more around the feeders when they're getting territorial and guarding their space. So.
Yeah, they aren't a pack creature. And yet you do see them when you have a feeder. There can be many of them that are coming around that feeder, but they're more like soloists navigating the world.
They are extremely independent. The females do not interact with other females unless it sometimes occasionally mother-daughter will nest close together. But the males are essentially, it's a war of all against all. And the males just want to breed. So they want to clear out their territory. And the space around the feeders becomes a contentious area because they want to drive all the other males out. That's just their nature.
Do the males make their own nests then?
No, the males, Chris, the males don't have anything to do with nesting. All they want to do is get as many females pregnant as possible. Hey. That's okay. All they care about. The males are aggressive and they shoot to kill. You know, they're not kidding around. They want to kill the other males. Which is why we get quite a few injured males. And the females don't fight that much because they're busy nesting and raising the young. And the females, some species have up to 6 babies a year. So 2 babies per nest, 3 nests a year. And then others, the Annas, will have maybe 2 nests a year. So 4 babies maximum. And then we have about 6 or 7 species in LA. So.
Now, when you talked about the mothers and daughters, maybe the only ones that would team up or hang out together, am I right in saying that you found something unique about that nesting and that maybe females are generally the ones that are born first?
Yes, Claire, I discovered that. And researchers couldn't possibly know this because you have to get thousands of nests from nature to see the pattern. So after a couple of years of rescuing hummingbirds, I noticed that the female was always the oldest one. And I started thinking, this isn't just a coincidence. There's no exceptions. So after seeing thousands of nests, I realized that yes, the female, and I first published this in my book, it's so amazing that nature figured this out. Because hummingbirds don't pair bond, you don't need that many males, unfortunately. So nature treats the males as dispensable. And so the female hatches first, and then the male hatches about 2 days later. And because he's younger and weaker, if anything goes wrong, he dies first. Or he'll get pushed out of the nest by the bigger sister, older sister, if it gets too small. But his existence is more precarious than the female. And nature preserved the females because it recognized, you know, because the breeding population was dependent on females and you only need a few males, it maximized the number of females by making them born first and giving them the highest rate of survival. It's amazing.
And that's all hummingbird species, no matter which
yes.
one.
Yes. And Chris, I don't know about other birds. I would love to see some research on that. You know, other birds usually have more babies. So songbirds will have 4 babies, but so I don't know, are the oldest ones the females? And I doubt it because the hummingbirds don't pair bond. So with songbirds, they do pair bond. So you need the same number of males as females. So nature probably didn't make that distinction over evolutionary time. And interestingly, it's another reason why hummingbirds don't imprint or bond, which is why I do hummingbirds. Because I'm a terrible enabler and I can't rehab like crows or ravens, which are corvids, because they pair bond like a dog. They bond to humans like a dog. So because they have the pair bond inclination, they bond with humans too. They bond with their human caregivers. But hummingbirds don't have the pair bond inclination. So when you let them go, you can see them again, but you will never touch them again. They will never come back and be your friend.
I was curious, you say that they have the ability to, you know, migrate thousands of miles and then, you know, the next year come back to the same feeder literally on mm-hmm. the same day. Do the Hummers come back to you or come back to the rehab facility to check in on you or say thanks?
There have been a few who've come back. There was one particular in particular that really made an impression on me. I named him Blacktop. He was a black chin male that was rescued. He the city road workers knocked him out of his nest with a truck when they were laying new asphalt, and he fell in the asphalt. So I named him Blacktop because he was a black chin too.
Right.
And I raised him. He was incredibly smart, super smart bird. When they're in the aviary, they will sit on your hand or come up and hover in front of you and want to be your friend. But once you release them, you can't touch them. But once I released Blacktop, he flew out and sat on the dowling rod that was sticking out of the aviary because we raised fruit flies inside the aviary for the young, and he knew that I would open that bucket every day, and he was sitting there ready for the fruit flies. So he just got all his free meals there. And then one day he was gone because it was September and he disappeared. And so I thought, okay, he migrated. In March of the following year, I came out one day. I was doing new rehab, new year of rehab, and Blacktop was sitting on the dowling, and he's the only bird that ever sat there. So I knew, and by now he was a mature adult male with the purple gorget, and I walked up to him and I said, "Blacktop," and he dropped down and hovered right in front of my face, and then flew back up to the dowling and was like, "Go shake the bucket so I can get some fruit flies, will you?" But he migrated to Mexico and back to that place. Can you imagine? I mean, I can't even find my way across town with GPS.
Right.
And this bird flew to Mexico and came back to my yard. And you've seen LA from the sky. How would you ever find your way back to the same yard?
How many
It's amazing.
different species are there of hummingbirds?
There's 300 and some, I think, and most of them are usually confined to smaller areas in Central America or South America, and they don't migrate. They just a lot of those stay year round, and they're small areas where that's the only place you see those species. The American species, about half of them migrate. And the other half do not. They just stay in LA all year round. But we're getting more and more species that are just hanging out in LA and staying there, like the rufous, which should migrate from Mexico to Alaska every year, which is a 7,000-mile journey. But now the rufous males are starting to stay in LA all year round. And we know this because we rescue them. And they're starting to breed with the Allans females. So we have a new species that's a hybrid rufous Allans.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Is that evolution of species happening? Are they coming together, and are we seeing an evolution in different types of hummingbirds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The hybrid is a new species, and they're extremely combative. They have all of the rufous attitude and personality, but they look a little bit like Allans. And the Allans females are indistinguishable in nature to the human eye. Unless you're extremely good, you can't see the difference between them. But the rufous males discovered that the Allans females will breed with them because their courtship displays are very similar. If you get two species that have very different male courtship displays, they won't interbreed because they're not speaking the same language. So Allans and Annas don't interbreed because the male courtship display of the Annas is much different from the Allans. But the rufous courtship display is very similar, so the Allans females respond. They're like, "Yeah, I get what he's saying."
So Terry, we're 30 or so years into a warming world, climate change. Are you seeing any evidence that that's having impacts on hummingbirds, say migratory paths or range or feeding habits, etc.?
There's so little research, Chris, and because they move around so much, it's really hard to nail down exact numbers. And like if you have a species that's confined to an area like mammalian species, much more easy to research their numbers and their habits. But because hummingbirds move around so much and they're up in the air most of the time, it's very tough to get research on the numbers. So it usually comes down to anecdotal reports like, oh, we're not getting as many hummingbirds here, or we're getting more hummingbirds in this area. I just can't say, but I something makes me suspect that the Rufus Allen's hybrids are a result of changing climate factors. I just don't know what they are. I can't really say.
Right. Well, here in Park City, we might be seeing there again, anecdotally, some people are saying that, well, the hummingbirds are arriving a few weeks earlier. They're staying a few weeks longer. And perhaps we may start to see new species that are, you know, ranging up into the mountains here. So, but like you say, Terry, it's still anecdotal in evidence.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. For example, I did an interview with a program in New York a few weeks ago, and someone reached out and said, we had a female Rufus overwinter in New York. Now, the Rufus should not be in New York. So they used to call those vagrants. I like to call them pioneers. I think they're colonizing new areas, possibly because they can. But how that female Rufus got to New York is anybody's guess, because they don't normally go east of the Mississippi. They just stay on the West Coast completely. But there were pictures of her in the snowstorm, so she definitely stayed. And then the person who was making sugar water for her all winter said she disappeared in the spring and didn't come back. So if they're unusual like that, you can identify a quote vagrant. Are they vagrants or are they just adjusting? I'm not sure. I mean, everything they do is so mysterious anyway. Yeah. Why not?
Totally, right. Totally independent, but so adorable, so lovable. You know, who doesn't love hummingbird visiting their backyard?
Sure. People are obsessed. The Angelenos are obsessed with hummingbirds and get very emotionally involved with them. Like this morning, I had two people break down and cry over the phone because the birds died. And then another guy just got really, he just had a complete freak out because I was trying to help him save an injured bird. And he was just too nervous, and he just completely freaked out on the phone. And so I become kind of a counselor in a psychiatric source as well.
I choked up just watching the trailer to your film.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, I know.
Because there's some more poignant and painful things in the film.
Yeah. Often we do talk about here a human's place in the natural world. And if we don't treat ourselves as paramount and coexist and have relationships with nature, there seems to be more of a peace. And I wanted to point out that in the film, you received a nest and you noticed that the nest contained strands of hair from the person that brought it in because it was in their yard. And the hummingbirds interconnected with that human in that way. How do you see a human's place in the natural world as you rehabilitate and as we explore our love for these creatures and our emotional attachment to them?
Because they nest so close to buildings and human settlements, they are much more involved in our world and part of our environment than most creatures. And they do use all of our debris, our laundry lint, our hair from our heads, you know, our paint chips off of our houses to make their nests. And then the nests are spun with spider webs. And so, of course, every day I do two or three releases of trapped birds that get trapped in houses, and those are nesting mothers coming in to get spider webs, and then they get disoriented. So they're so involved with us. But what I try to teach people, and you don't really have to work that hard, because people really do love hummingbirds and are very emotionally connected to them, is that we are a part of this world just as much as they are. And if we get too urban, we forget that nature is our home. And we need to carve out that space for our own, you know, our own sanity and our own welfare and stay connected to it, so we don't go nuts just being on our phones and computers 24/7. It's just very dangerous for us to live without nature.
Well, the film is absolutely beautiful. Every Little Thing is what it's called, and it has been described. I want to do a couple quotes because I think that they're very relevant. Next Big Picture had said that the film is a rejuvenating one that will leave you with a sense that the world is going to be all right. And Variety calls it balm in a season aching for uplift. So I think those are messages that we all need, and there are reasons why people are really attached themselves to this beautiful film. We think you're incredible. And we thank you so much for joining us here on This Green Earth. And if listeners want to learn more about your film and about you, where would they go to do that? Is there a website?
Yes, I do have a website, Los Angeles Hummingbird Rescue, which, you know, I have to put my phone number out there because the rescues are urgent. And if people don't get to me immediately, bad things happen. So LA Hummingbird Rescue gets several thousand visits every year, and it has the book Fastest Things on Wings and the film Every Little Thing on the website if people want to see it. So and the film is still in theaters for another 2 months. So.
Oh, great!
And just screened here in Park City. And you're the best of humanity. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Claire.
So thank you so much for being part of This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us is our guest, Stephanie Anderson. Stephanie is an assistant professor of creative writing at Florida Atlantic University, author of the new book, From the Ground Up, The Women Revolutionizing Regenerative Agriculture. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we always like to start interviews with a little background on our guests. And so tell us a little bit about yourself. I think you were born and raised on a farm.
I was. I was born and raised on my parents' ranch in western South Dakota. It was a really great childhood experience, adolescence. Worked on the farm a lot, things like riding horses and, you know, swathing hay, things like that. I made my way to Florida and I studied creative writing. It was always something that I was interested in, and got my master's, and then now I'm teaching. So there's a lot in between there, but I've managed to stay in agriculture in terms of my writing and what I'm concerned about in terms of themes for my work. So that's kind of how I've had one foot in both places.
Let's get a little definition of terms. Regenerative agriculture. What is regenerative agriculture, and say, how may it differ from traditional agriculture, let's say?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it really just means a set of farming and ranching practices that don't just maintain the status quo, but instead look to improve and foster ecological health. A few modern examples of that would be things like rotating livestock across the land in ways that mimic, you know, the historical movement of buffalo and other species of wild animals, and planting cover crops to keep living roots in the soil all year round, just like the prairie environment once was. And so this all just builds organic matter and biodiversity in ways that traditional cropping doesn't, because often traditional and more conventional cropping that uses things like tillage or chemical management and more intense grazing that is not so good. It's overgrazing in a lot of cases. So regenerative boosts the health of water cycles, increases crop nutrient density, it draws down carbon and fuels above ground life of all kinds. So it's basically applying nature's processes to food production. So cycling nutrients in that more natural way. And it's not new. This is not something that we've come up with overnight. Indigenous societies around the world were practicing, and many still do, what today we would call regenerative agriculture and livestock stewardship. And they, of course, deserve credit for that. The other side of the coin, too, regenerative is not some old-fashioned relic of the past that can't keep up with our modern food production. It's, many industrial norms and philosophies are not part of regenerative, like massive monoculture fields and genetically modified crops. But other modern things like technology, equipment, and tools can make that scalable. So it is both old and new.
And regenerative agriculture, you use the example of ranching, cattle ranching, but it could also be applied to other forms of, say, livestock raising, and maybe even just pure plants or vegetables and fruit raising too?
Absolutely. Regenerative is more of a mindset than any kind of one specific set of practices. So you can apply that in all kinds of methods of production. So the key thing with regenerative is diversity. So the more diversity we can get per acre, the better. So often that means integrating crops and livestock, providing different kinds of crops rather than monocultures, especially too when it comes to livestock. We want to be cycling nutrients through our livestock in ways that, again, mirror that natural movement of animals and presence of animals on the land. So we can bring all kinds of production from our food crops all the way to our cereal crops and more. Yeah.
And I don't think I'm venturing too far out to say that when most of us conjure up that vision of a farmer or a rancher, it's usually quintessentially a man in overalls with a pitchfork or something along those lines. Why was it important for you to paint a vivid portrait of women in these roles, and in particular as leaders moving forward in regenerative agriculture industry?
Yeah, so As I mentioned, I come from a pretty industrial agricultural community in South Dakota, and I worked as a journalist for a while there too. And it really might sound odd, but I just didn't realize how male-centered the more conventional agriculture space was until I moved away. When I was working on this particular book, I was looking at the food system more broadly, and I was looking at change that was spanning that was happening on the land, but also moving through various parts of the food system, like everywhere from community organizing to legislating to policymaking to connecting capital with new regenerative projects and to things like distribution. And everywhere I looked, women were being put forth as, you should talk to this woman, talk to this woman. And it just seemed like this movement was broader than the land, and it was really moving through the food system. So I just think that, you know, it starts with that stereotype of farmers as maybe white, maybe male, maybe older. And this regenerative movement is far more diverse in terms of race and gender and sexual orientation compared to the industrial space. And of course, above all, I wanted women and men alike to see aspects of themselves presented in this narrative, and women in particular, because they've often been doing the work of farming, but not necessarily getting the credit or acknowledgement that they deserve.
What farms did you visit? Give us some examples of what you experienced and wrote about.
I loved the farms that I visited, and there were so many that I visited that didn't make it in the book, just for space constrictions. But I visited a young female Lakota rancher in South Dakota, raising livestock on the land in ways that was drawing on her traditional knowledge and her with a modern spin. And that was really exciting. I visited a mother-daughter farming duo in North Carolina. They were working on land that's been in their family for generations, all the way back to their enslaved ancestors. And they've kept this land in the family, and it just means so much. And they're doing really exciting work in the raising regenerative food for their community. I visited a brother-sister duo in Missouri who actually transitioned a really conventional row crop operation, corn and soybeans, very typical Corn Belt operation, into a diversified livestock and cover crop operation. And they managed to break the cycle of years of industrial agriculture in their family and bring more people to the land per acre than their grandparents and parents had been able to support, and just really make a farm for the future. So those were three examples that were really exciting to me.
And you kind of touched on this, but you importantly shed a light on the roots of regenerative agriculture and its beginnings with African American, Latino, and Asian cultures. You put an emphasis on this. Why do you think it's important to look back and honor these practices as we look forward?
Yeah, I love that question because, you know, they worked. They worked for all of human history in which we were doing stewardship on the land, and they fed the population, and they were in keeping with the environment, and they were not causing the type of ecological harm that some of our modern farming practices, like intense agrochemical use, for example, are perpetuating on the land. So we know that these systems work because they had to work before what is a relatively new application of, you know, really industrial practices of mass production on the land. So, and just to honor that agricultural stewardship does not start with white people in Europe. I mean, this is definitely something that has deep, important roots in other cultures. And it just kind of helps break down that farmer stereotype that we have, and that really isn't realistic in terms of what's happening on the land in many cases.
You know, one, I guess I'll call it kind of maybe a pushback on the regenerative process farming is that it's not profitable, or it's more of a boutique type of approach to farming. Although ironically, as you alluded to, Stephanie, you know, 50 years ago, this was called farming, you know? But so many farms are industrial in nature, and whether it's farms growing crops, or like say ranching or poultry farms or so, they are monocultured, monocrop type of farming, because that's where the efficiency lies. How do you respond to that and compel farmers who maybe like the regenerative process as aspirational, but can't see that working on their farm?
So what you've described is often the message that's really coming from Big Ag, from the top down, that and stoking fear, honestly, in terms of what farmers can realistically do in a profitable way on the land, because we have data that supports side-by-side comparisons of profit per acre, and these are cited in the book. Comparing, for example, a row crop operation in the upper Midwest, conventional and regenerative is more profitable per acre. Their input costs are so much lower, especially now when we have inflated prices and they're all oil-based, so they're very dependent on imports. And, you know, we have so many other forms of inputs that regenerative producers do not have to get completely hooked on for their operation to be successful. And then two, regenerative operations produce more food output per acre, in the sense of we have more crops coming off the land, whether that's a livestock addition, whether it's several crops per season, whether we're marketing cover crops, whether we're doing intercropping or multi-cropping. And so we're able to grow more food per acre compared to a more industrial monoculture setup. So, and we have, you know, we have data to support that as well. And, you know, with the families that I visited, they're able to use that profit to bring more people back to the farm. So farms can support more children, more people in the next generation, which is so good for our rural economies as well. And finally, regenerative is scalable. We know that we have producers who are working on operations that span thousands of acres, and they're able to use those regenerative methods and philosophies and still be very profitable, even at scale. And we have big food companies that are helping facilitate this transition, getting their big cereal grain suppliers, for example, to move toward regenerative production. Mm-hmm. So we also have small or more boutique farmers, as you mentioned, pioneering some of these things at the local and small level, but we also have people on the other end of the food chain that are making this happen at scale. So it's absolutely something that we can apply to the food system beyond kind of the smaller level.
Can you dive a little bit further into how all of what you just mentioned helps us as we look at climate change and weathering that?
Yeah, farmers are running out of time to transition their acres to regenerative production. Unfortunately, we're seeing a lot more erratic weather that's impacting farmers. We see hotter temperatures. For example, the wheat belt in North America is shifting northward. So farmers who are more on the southern end of the wheat belt are finding it's too dry and are not able to do that. We have far more instability as farming in our farming world, and farming's already unstable. And farming is already difficult enough without that added level of instability. So when it comes to climate change, regenerative, one of the main principles is keep a living root in the ground at all times, and don't disturb the soil more than you have to, which prevents the release of carbon. So we're decreasing in a big way how much carbon is released through our farming. So that's really important. But also our soils store more water, so that water is saved and not lost due to evaporation, and our soils are not being lost to erosion. And all of this helps make farms more resilient when we have things like floods or droughts. So that's another thing that helps farmers address climate change. And also, to go back to the diversity again, regenerative operations with that diversity have more marketable crops in case one fails. It helps build that not all egg in one basket mentality, so that if we have a climate event, these farms don't go under. They're growing more crops rather than fewer. So all these things combined help make farms, just put them in a stronger position when it comes to the uncertainties that they're already facing out there on the land.
And the potential for using less chemicals on the soil too, or on the crops themselves or such, whether it's fertilizer and then, you know, on to herbicides and pesticides and fungicides and, you know, every side you can imagine that gets applied to the soil and just wears it out eventually. So not to say that regenerative agriculture is necessarily organic agriculture. Do I have that correct? I mean, regenerative agriculture can still use chemicals in some form to control pests, right?
Correct. So regenerative doesn't have, at the moment, we're still building consensus around what exact practices are part and are not. But in general, the regenerative outlook is minimize when it comes to agrochemicals. Save them for something where you just cannot manage without them, versus the yearly and multi-yearly application of industrial. And right, so organic does not allow some of the chemicals that may be allowed on a sparing, you know, basis in regenerative operation. But on the flip side, organic allows things that wouldn't be part of a regenerative operation, like monoculture cropping or keeping poultry in those massive barns of many thousands of animals, or sort of having these massive fields that are not diverse at all. So there are some practices that are, yes, allowed maybe under regenerative that wouldn't be under organic, but the flip side is also true. So regenerative looks at takes a holistic approach, like what is best for this land resource. And occasionally a one-time chemical application could be the best thing. Sure. And occasionally, you know, but we also know that diversity is always going to be better for the land, because that's what's found in nature. And that's not always required by the organic rules.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
We have a regenerative farm that is not far from here. And what I hear from them is a lot, obviously, of what you're saying. And also, there's a lot of partnership and partnering with landowners to help out with regenerating what is natural for their property. Are you finding that as well, like these partnerships are happening?
I do. Regenerative operators are such a great group of people. They're eager to share information, because some of that information just isn't coming from the USDA or for other institutional sources. They have to kind of go out and find it on their own. And often that comes from peer-to-peer relationships, like on the land. So, and also that is one of the most effective ways for farmers to adapt to new techniques or try new techniques. If someone next door is doing it and can tell them about it, that's always more effective. So I have seen, this woman's story is not in the book, unfortunately, but, you know, a female rancher who was working to become certified as a holistic management expert to help others. And so lead these kind of training workshops on the land and farm tours, things like that. And yeah, it's really exciting because they're building up a set of resources that farmers can use to make that transition or to keep their operations going and become even more successful.
Are you seeing, say, universities or other institutions like that also kind of embracing regenerative processes or options in the classroom?
There has been some movement to that. Various universities may have like a center for regenerative agriculture that didn't exist 10 years ago, things like that. I wonder sort of in the current times whether that might be scaled back a little bit. So I hope that those efforts will sort of resist the movement to kind of dismantle some of that more forward-thinking institutional outlook toward climate change or toward environment. Mm-hmm.
So in looking at the book, you distinctively sectioned it off into disturbance, momentum, direction, and motion. Can you talk us through why that is sectioned in that way and how it helped you build the case for regenerative farming?
When I was writing the book, I envisioned this sort of green wave moving through the food system. And so those names, those terms are parts of a wave that, you know, sort of the scientific terms or the more professional terms for a wave. And so I started at the bottom on the land, not because it was least important, but because it was felt like that's where the groundswell of change was coming from. It was coming from producers wanting to make change on their land. So I kind of moved through various examples of that in the book, people on the land, and then kind of move upward through the food system to things like education, distribution, like a policy making and, bringing local, connecting local producers and consumers and things like bringing capital to some of these projects that really needs this type of startup funds. And so moving all the way from the where the food is actually produced all the way up through the food chain and then to the very top, which is Washington, D.C., which is where so much of our food and ag policy is determined and then flows back down to the farmers. So it was kind of like this movement that was rippling through the food system. And I tried to capture that through the sectioning.
And you mentioned that women-owned farms are being supported by women-owned investment firms. Mm-hmm. And then the farm-to-table movement includes, you know, women-owned restaurants, et cetera. So lots of networking going on there from soil to, like, say, soil to fork.
Yeah. What's exciting is that women are, in my opinion, and in the research I've done, are uniquely gifted at seeing that kind of web of relationships and the holistic approach, not just to their farms or their businesses, but also to the future and how their decisions and their leadership sort of reverberate into the future. And so women tend to lead with empathy and collaboration when their leadership styles are studied. And so when we see that on the farm, that looks like thinking about the next generation and considering, well, how does the food that I produce help nourish the next generation? Or how do my decisions protect this land resource for the next generation? And thinking about the farm and what it produces, and not just in a profit sense, but in, is this food nutritionally dense? Like, do we have a lot of, high nutrient density to what I'm producing so that it brings health to people? Are my efforts helping my local community, helping make sure that my neighbors are doing well like I am? Is this fueling a positive effect for the ecological environment of my farm? So balancing all of those things, it seems that women are uniquely gifted. And that's definitely not to say that men don't do that or can't do that. There are so many very amazing regenerative farmers and ranchers and leaders out there that are male, of course. This is more of just like kind of embracing that mindset and celebrating and recognizing the unique ways that women can really be part of that.
I love the sentiment of that farmers are not land pillagers, but nurturers, because I think there's a big difference there in thinking about extraction and then how you nurture and almost empathize with the land and what it's going through to provide for you.
Yeah, it's a totally different mindset. It's such a different way of looking at farming than the more conventional industrial model where you are extracting, you're squeezing out whatever you can per acre, even if it's at the cost of your soil resource or it's going to have long-term detrimental effects. If you just look at short-term profits, you're totally missing the opportunities for the longer-term and more widespread and significant benefits that your work can do. And that's one part of the regenerative philosophy that is really exciting to me, that it is definitely more than about this short-term attitude. And I think in a changing world, in a climate change, in a climate change environment, we have to think that way.
In just another minute or so, you said in the introduction, you're at Florida Atlantic University, which is down in South Florida. I spent time in South Florida working on the Everglades, the restoration of the Everglades. And of course, one of the big challenges there in restoration is that large, huge agricultural farms, industrial ag farms, sugarcane, large winter vegetable crops and such, and then cattle ranching. Any signs that regenerative farming might be catching on as a part of the solution to saving the Everglades down in South Florida?
Yeah, that's a great question, because right, the way that the water environment has been re-engineered in that part of the country, it just means that agricultural offflow is really impacting that area, as you said, particularly with water quality. So right, we're part of that is restoring the natural flow of the Everglades and making sure that we're not getting dirty water essentially down there. But two, yes, regenerative, I think, can play a role. I mean, especially in that type of soil in the Everglades, former Everglades that have been drained, that soil really, when it's exposed to oxygen, it really subsides. So subsidence is a huge problem. So yeah, farmers there have, a particular challenge in terms of keeping their soil resource, and regenerative is probably one of the only ways that they can help protect it for as long as they can. They just really have very thin soil there. So, right. I do hope that we can see some, you know, application of regeneration, integration of those practices, not only for the Everglades, but just for, you know, the whole community there.
Well, the name of the book is From the Ground Up, The Women Revolutionizing Regenerative Agriculture. The author is Stephanie Anderson. Stephanie, do you have a website that people, our listeners, can go to learn more about you and your other writings?
I do. It is stephanieandersonwriting.com.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you.